So, right, just to be clear, when we say alien rocks at Avebury, we don't mean kryptonite from Krypton on planet Earth. We mean cobbles from up north in prehistoric Wiltshire. Still with us? Stick around. So, cobbles from up north, what on earth do we mean? And at Avebury, what do we mean by that? It's full of surprises, this story, isn't it?
It's lovely, actually. On so many levels, it's lovely. Yes. We're looking West Kennet, really, aren't we? Which is south of Avebury a little bit.
Yeah.
And they have found stones, small stones, they're only pebble size, in some of the pits at West Kennet. And these stones came from nearly 300 miles away.
Yeah.
It's really very exciting. It's like... they can't have come by accident. People brought them.
So, Avebury, down in Wiltshire, not far away from Silbury Hill. In fact, you can see the site where these rocks were found from Silbury Hill or from West Kennet Longbarrow. Hopefully, I've got a little map up on the screen so, you know, we've got an idea of where it came from. And there's a lot more to this story. And we're going to launch off and talk directly about the stones, but there's a backstory to this concerning the complex that the stones were found in. But we'll do that towards the back end of this this little show, so we don't get bogged down in too much detail. Yeah, so who found them? You know, the excavation when these were found was done in summers of 2019 and 2021, I think.
Was it? I think it was 21. I think they missed out 20, didn't they, because of COVID?
I think they did because of COVID. That is quite correct. And they were investigating a small area of what is called the West Kennet Palisaded Enclosures, which we will talk more about along, but a bit of it called Structure 5, which is a really quite a small area of that whole thing, which is a load of timber enclosures, enormous timber enclosures. But this one, you know, is just a small part of it. And so their socks were knocked off on two counts, really. A, you know, the strange rocks that they found, and B, the intensity of the and depth of the timber posts that they were finding in this small area. And the speculations are about, you know, what's whether it was a square building, round building, you know, what the whole purpose. And, of course, weird things with the dating. But the rocks, how many of them were found altogether?
77.
77. And was it seven of those were actually associated with a burial?
They were in a circle around a small burial, yes.
Yeah, which in turn was in the top of one of the huge post holes in this area.
Yes.
As were some of the, lots of the other rocks, you know, tended to be in the tops of these post holes, which it seems have been there for some time. But more of that anon. So there aren't any secure dates to this, but we're looking at anything from 2005 to 2300 BC. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's a multi-period overall. It's a multi-period site that people clearly have been living there for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
But yes, these stones are associated with the later inclusions. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. They're in the tops of not necessarily the top, but close to the tops of these post holes. So not when the timber posts were there, it would seem. It's like reuse to have a burial, for example, in one of those pits that used to contain a post. That's quite interesting.
The archaeologists involved, have you got their names to hand there? Josh Pollard.
In front of me? No, are you talking about the original? We've got Josh Pollard.
Mark Gillings, Ben Chan, Rosamund Cleal, Stu Eve, and Joshua Pollard. Now, the interesting aspects were, of course, they don't have the skills. They're archaeologists. They have their own set of skills before anybody starts saying, yeah. But petrology is very, very particular. Yeah. And there are two gentlemen in particular whose names rise to the top here. And we're talking about Rob Ixer and Richard Bevins. They're the pair that have been analysing the Welsh bluestones at Stonehenge and have definitively found through their petrology that not only the general area of where the bluestones come from, but you know the particular quarry sites where they've come from. So it's Rob Ixer and Richard Bevins who are on this case as well. Shall I just read what they themselves say about these rocks? Hopefully,
just that brief intro. Yes, yeah, do yeah. It kind of gives it a context. Yes.
So they say at first sight, samples from the West Kennet excavations, ranging in size from heavily weathered cobbles to sand grains, look like sandstone, very friable, coarse grained, greenish grey, micaceous. Is that how you pronounce it? And arcosic, rich in feldspar, apparently. Rich in feldspar. However, as they showed spheroidal onion skill weathering, typical of igneous rocks, we thin sectioned them for routine petrographical analysis. To our surprise, this showed that this feldspathic sandstone was not sedimentary, but a highly altered igneous rock with an unusual composition. It was grus. Coarse sand and gravel that results from intense weathering and decomposition of granitic rocks. And it's not native to Wiltshire. That's the thing.
No.
It is.
No, not at all.
Exotic, very exotic to Wiltshire, if taken in the, you know, whole context of Britain.
Now, I was just going to say, it is breathtaking. The lengths to which they went to isolate where these stones could have come from.
Yeah.
It's astonishing, actually. The chemical analysis down to the most incredible degree to make sure that it wasn't this outcrop from Scotland and it wasn't that outcrop from the Lake District. It's breathtaking work how they've pinned it down.
Yeah, and we wouldn't pretend to understand a word of it because it's full of...
One or two,
maybe.
Yeah,
but it is hinged on particular processes in petrology and chemical and being able to identify the component parts of the nomenclature is beyond our ken. However, that said, one of the major parts in discerning which outcrop or which outcrops are most favourable to be the origin of these rocks is actually dating. It's a technique involving the levels of zircon in whatever samples you take, and apparently by lead uranium or is it uranium lead dating. The zircon component can be dated. We're talking now about rocks, so we're talking about millions and millions and millions of years. So one of the favoured sites for the origins of this
400 million,
the Lake District. It was the Lake District, but it turned out from this analysis that the Lake District was that rock was 40 million years too early for it to be this. So the only candidates left were rocks from the Cheviot Hills. And am I pronouncing Cheviot right? Is it Cheviot?
Yes.
Hills. It is. Okay,
cool. Do you know what? I've always said Cheviot.
Cheviot. Okay, fair enough. Up north, 280 miles away from where we're talking about now in Northumbria. Yeah. And in particular, they think they may have narrowed it down to an outcrop called Cunyon Crags. So those are the basic facts We haven't left anything out about that, have we, really?
Not that matters from this context, I don't think, you know.
And nondescript apart from that.
That's probably the most important aspect of this, isn't it? The fact that they are just a nondescript stone. It means that, okay, you can't say any of this with certainty. You can only go with what feels logical, really, that people were bringing these stones from one place to a new place. And the fact that they are just, they're not even pretty stones in any way. They're not any particular size. It's just they've brought a piece of a place to a place. So it's the fact that it's the place that mattered, not the pretty stone. And that, it's, you know, we've talked about, at length, people have talked about, you know, how it's been proven that the blue stones at Stonehenge came from the Preseli's. So there was this thing about taking a place to a place. And so now to have this thing where these little stones have been taken by people, that it puts it on a personal level. It's not this industrial level of taking an entire, you know, collection of massive stones somewhere. It's where, you know, even children could have put these things in their pockets and carried them to a new place. I find that so evocative and romantic. You know, what was going on? My understanding is that outside of, so where we're talking about, you know, at the West Kennet Palisades, structure five, as Michael said earlier on, structure five is just a small structure within this complex. And my understanding is that none of the grus, these small stones, none of them have been found outside of structure five. Now,
that's correct.
Again,
let me add to that that the rest of the enclosures have been very well excavated. So, although there's a possibility that some may be missed, but the, what Rupert just said stands, that they haven't been found elsewhere in the environs. Yeah. Sorry, Rupert, carry on.
No, that's all right. So, you know, what are we talking about? A family or a small social group moving to, you know, you know, is it a new home? Obviously, we couldn't possibly know these things other than the fact that it is so isolated or, you know, discreet in this one place, these stones from 280 miles away. It's amazing.
Let me just dispel with something that, you know, some people may be thinking. They're going, oh, well, it could easily have been transported by glaciation. Well, not so fast, because even if, I mean, it's a possibility that these stones could have been part of a glacial till that was shoved down Britain, what, it would have been, what, 8,000 years before we're talking about the age, 8,000, 10,000 years before the age we're talking about right now.
At least.
But the glaciation only reached, even then, didn't reach into Wiltshire. I'm trying to think of the boundaries exactly where the glaciation reached. But my thing with whether glaciation or not, it would still have needed human element to get the stones the rest of the way. But even with that, why would you? I mean, it's one thing alone to say, why would you bring these stones all the way from their source, where they could were in one place? By the time these stones have been tilled and churned over in glacial till, coming all those miles, they'll have been completely randomised with the rest of the till picked up by the glacier. Why would you spend time seeking out these nondescript lumps of rock from the other lumps of rock in glacial till to bring them, then that's even a weirder question than having brought them stock and barrels.
I think you're absolutely all the way right. And, you know, the you know, obviously the researchers have to put that in, you know, to say that, okay, this is possible as well. But when you think about it logically, that if something had been transported, as Mike was just saying, if something's been transported by glaciation, and all mixed up and scattered, and now you're looking for those to take them somewhere else, as opposed to, no, they really did come from 280 miles away at this outcrop. Because then if it was an outcrop where people were living, say, then they would just each have picked up a stone that was right by their feet. They don't have to go looking for them across the landscape. It's right that you feed in the possibility, but you know, it's not likely, I don't think.
So we can't learn from this what people were actually thinking that had them bring these stones. But what is fascinating about this is that it's another feather in the cap of thinking in terms of the interconnectedness and the amount to which people were travelling back way, way, way back in time. We've got so much evidence of movement, trade and exchange. We've got bluestones from Wales going to Stonehenge. We've got two out of the five people buried in the stage one of Stonehenge. Two out of the five people buried there were from Wales. The West Kennet palisaded enclosures, two of the pigs that have been excavated, or bones from pigs excavated there, seems they had their origins in Wales somewhere, or indeed the Lake District. There's a massive flint core.
Flint core
was found
in one of the ditches
nearby that is provenanced from Norfolk, most likely Grimes Graves. Flint, you know, what's that doing there? How did it get there? It's a big, big piece. I've seen it. It's in the Stonehenge exhibition at the British Museum. It's big, heavy.
It's a big piece.
It's a big piece. Arrowheads.
From Bridlington, yes.
Yeah, well, the style, matching the style, yeah.
And possibly, stone-wise, possibly from around the same location as the Grus came from as well, which is another interesting aspect there. And then the pottery, there was grooved ware from Rudston.
Well, it matches the style. It matches, it's not actually from... Not actually from Rudston.
Rudston, obviously, is it's home to Britain's tallest standing stone, not to mention a number of cursus monuments in the landscape as well. It was, you know, a complex place. So it's a clear, very, very clear marker that people were travelling from far and wide to come to West Kennet.
I think that's the main takeaway from all of this, I think. And I think although it's a wonderful playground for speculation as to why people would bring lumps of rock from Northumbria to Wiltshire.
But, we'll do you know what? You say that. But don't you think, though, that we don't stop doing it now? The fact is that now we have industrialised making of nonsense. Every time we go anywhere, we buy souvenirs and we bring them home. We go on holiday, we bring a whatever it is. We buy something from somewhere and take it back home. So you're talking about a time when, well, people weren't there weren't shops and service stations for buying all sorts of nonsense. They took stuff somewhere else from. You know, it just makes sense to me.
It'll always remain speculation, is my point, as to what people's relationship to these particular stones may have been. You see, they may have had a practical use, all knowledge of which has gone, you know, and so we'll never be able to discern, you know, if there were the material bags that contained them were there, we might be able to have a guess if you know, whatever container they were in. That kind of thing. They may have been practical rather than sentimental, even though we must remember that seven of them were used to mark this grave or celebrate this grave or whatever. So, that's enough about stones. We can't say any more about the Grus.
No.
Oh, are
we
saying
just
that
a
word,
very
right?
romantic thing.
Is it Grus? Grus or... Is it
it's
even
got to be
in-
Grus. It's not. No, if it was Grus, it would be two S's.
I know. But it could be. It's conceivable that it's Gru. It's conceivable that it's Gru. Tumbleweed.
That's true.
But we've never heard it spoken, so
true.
It's going to be gros. It's going to be gros.
Except if you're suggesting that it came from the French, which would make it gros, then yeah.
Let's not.
No,
we're not going to come to any conclusions here. So I think we'd better move on. So that's enough about the stones. I don't know if we've left enough time to talk about the palisaded enclosures and the background to them. I think best we can do is sort of, rather than us try to describe them here, is give you enough sort of a little bit of a background so you can go off and find out for yourselves about the palisaded enclosures. We're taking a deep breath there to ready yourself for a concise description of what we're talking about.
The palisaded enclosures, all right, so you have potentially these very tall timber posts that are sunk a long way into the ground. In some cases, they're sunk 3 meters into the ground. I mean, that is a lot. That's a huge depth to make sure that they don't slip. And the interesting thing here is that they're close set. They don't butt to each other. They're close set. Now, this is maybe not the time to go into our rationale about that, but you know, it's an interesting feature that you could walk between these posts. They weren't butted tight together. The eastern of the two main palisades, one of them crossed the River Kennet, which is interesting. The western enclosure is just to the south of the Kennet. They're both of them very, very close to
how many yards across do you reckon is to give people a sense of scale.
I can't remember off the top of my head. They're big. They're big enclosures. I mean, they're the size of Avebury almost, aren't they?
About 300 yards across. Something like that.
It's 300 yards? Big. They are big.
And there are all sorts of complications. There's straight rows. You know, there are smaller circles, smaller enclosures, signs of habitation, obviously. But there's something controversial about the dating, which we won't go into now. But it seems, if the dating is right, this whole complex has been in use in one way or another over a very long period. And it's so interesting that it's just, you know, I was going to say stone's throw from Avebury, from Silbury Hill, from West Kennet.
Very good.
The Ridgeway, the prehistoric trackway, you know, that heads up to the north up there, and from the sanctuary, which is the other monument just over to the northeast.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say, what was the word that you used? Controversial? Did you say the dating?
The dating. Not controversial, but debatable, shall we say.
Well, I see, because I think that the qualifier for me is that the reason that it's controversial or it's been considered controversial is because the dating was unexpected. To my mind, we shouldn't be surprised by it because, you know, as we said before, what it shows is that people were living in that one place for a very, very long period of time. It was just previously it was expected that all the dating would come in, you know, at around, you know, a date. But it's actually, there's like 1,000 years unexpected shift. So I find that not surprising at all, frankly.
But we're getting into the weeds here, you know, getting into the long grass because we can't get into the background behind all this, behind all the dating, you know, in the small amount of time that we've got. My advice would be, you know, to have a good Google search about West Kennet Palisades and the whole thing, and find out the details for yourself. It is unquestionably one of the most important complexes. I won't use the word monument, but you know what I mean. structures, I think, that's going to tell us a lot about prehistory, you know, in the end of the Neolithic, mid-Neolithic, and towards the end of the Neolithic and the beginning of the Beaker period, you know, depending on what comes out of the archaeology. All that said, all it tells to me, and, you know, we'll like to have your feedback on this, but it makes me feel, I think, Rupert, you feel the same, that the whole subject of the Avebury complex, when you include everything, is probably going to be more telling if more stuff comes out of it. It's going to be more telling than the whole of the Stonehenge complex.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
There's so many varied aspects to this whole area that aren't quite present at Stonehenge. Mm. Stonehenge tends to get a little bit of a narrow focus, you know, Durrington walls, yeah, but bluestones, yeah, but there seems to be a breadth of subject matter to be encompassed at Avebury that we'd love to actually do something about. So, you know, will that happen?
Yeah.
I don't know.
There is a lot to be dug up about that. Apologies for that, but there is a lot to be dug up. Certainly true. And it does, as we said before, it just shows that people were travelling from far and wide to come to Avebury. You know, and that in itself is exciting, how much people were getting around back then.
So as you rightly said, there is much to be dug up, and we dig deeper so you don't have to.
Yes, we do.
How cheesy are we? let us leave it there. Thank you so much for watching, everybody, and for listening, of course, if you're on audio only. Hope you found that interesting and illuminating a little bit, and hope you find there's fruit for further investigations. With that, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you next time. Bye.